Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 100, The Third Era. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we have made it to episode 100. We've actually put out more than 100 pieces of material over the almost 2 years that we've been operating as a podcast. We've released various bonus episodes and other material, but this is officially episode 100. And we are so excited to celebrate this milestone with our guest today, Rabbi Irving Yitz Greenberg, whose thought really in many ways is at the core of the thinking that we have been doing over this time. We see ourselves very much as building on the foundation that he laid, and we're so excited and honored to have him on our show today for episode 100 to sort of go through his thinking now about the big ideas that he brought into the world decades ago and has been working on ever since. So let me give a few words of introduction. He is the founding president of the organization Klal, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. We've had a number of guests from Klal on the show before, and we will again soon. Yitz Greenberg served as the founding president of Klal from 1974 to 1997. In addition to that, he was the director of the President's Commission on the Holocaust from 1979 to 1980, which was the organization that eventually conceived of and supervised the creation of the United States Holocaust Museum. Yitz Greenberg started his career as a thinker and theologian looking at the meaning of the Holocaust for Judaism moving forward. He's also a very influential figure in Jewish-Christian dialogue in the latter part of the 20th century. And in the 1990s, he worked with the philanthropist Michael Steinhardt to create the Steinhardt Foundation Jewish Life Network, which is now called the Steinhardt Foundation for Jewish Life, which was one of the early philanthropic projects that looked in a different way about funding entrepreneurial projects in the Jewish community. In many ways, it was the ancestor of a lot of the things that are going on today in terms of Jewish philanthropy and the kinds of entrepreneurial endeavors that are being funded by that philanthropy. We are thrilled to have him here today to discuss the implications of his thought that was developed in the 20th century on our work in the 21st century. So, Yitz Greenberg, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's a great honor to have you.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be here.
So I first heard the ideas about what you call the third era at a talk you gave at the Hartman Institute about 5 years ago, and it's stuck with me ever since. And I think that in many ways, it's the background music for a lot of the thinking that Lex and I have been doing in terms of thinking about new ways that Judaism can be reimagined and the more central role that what we call regular Jews might play in that. And I was hoping that we could just start out with you giving a sort of 40,000-foot view of your very complex work on this, and then we'll sort of dive more into the details. But I was hoping that you could lay out the basic ideas of what you call the three eras of Judaism and where we are in Jewish history.
The first era of Jewish history, you might say, is the Bible. And in the Bible, we have a very powerful central message of the Jewish religion, still is, that the world will be redeemed, that the world will be perfected, that the human humanity is in a partnership with God to do so. But all the characteristics, the institutions, the worship, the so on, very much grow out of a picture of a dominant God who is the dominant partner and who really controls everything that humans do. After the destruction of the temple, I came to the conclusion that the rabbis, the new leadership, and new institutions emerge because God, as it were, gives up control because wants humans to take on more responsibility and to take on more authority. Thus, no more revelation from heaven. The rabbis have to figure out what God wants of us at this very moment. And one could go a lot of other areas in the temple people were much more passive. In the synagogue, people are much more participatory and active and so on. Now, my question is, and this is what I've come to the conclusion, that the Holocaust and Israel show that God has again self-limited. One might say we're living in an age when God is totally hidden, when the intervention, the control, the history is not seen, but rather God acts through humans. That is to say, in this third era, God has asked humans to take full responsibility for the outcome of the covenant. So to put it in the simplest fashion possible, we're living in the third age, the age when the humans are fully responsible, when God is totally present but hidden. And I think my guess is the future, 1,000 years from now, this will be called the lay Judaism or the lay era of Judaism, just as we have biblical Judaism with priests and prophets and rabbinic Judaism with rabbis and teachers. This third era will be the era of the lay leadership and of a hidden God and a human responsibility.
One of the ways that you articulated that back when I heard you speak, which I thought was just really beautiful and empowering, is this idea that in each of these eras, as God sort of withdraws further back, two things happen, and I'd love for you to describe both of them. You know, one is that there's a dimension in which, although withdrawing, God is also coming closer, and the other being that as God withdraws in the way that God is withdrawing, more responsibility falls on the shoulders of human beings, and therefore more human beings are needed to shoulder the responsibility. And we move from a hereditary priesthood to a rabbinate that's expanded but not hereditary. And how do we get to that third stage? You know, what does that look like where human beings shoulder all of that responsibility?
Well, first of all, thank you for noticing that point, because people are confused sometimes. When I speak of God giving up control or God becoming more hidden, I don't believe God is withdrawing. That's historically one of the ways it's interpreted. God is turning away from people, or of course, in the secular version, God is distancing because the God isn't there. But my point is, and this is the rabbi's point, but I think it applies today also. God is more hidden, but God is actually more present. When God was more visible, more transcendent, more dramatic control, intervention, miracles, visible miracles, and so on, God was also very unapproachable. One could not see God without dying. One could not touch in sacred places without being killed, as it were. So the rabbi said God had become more hidden, but God is actually present. But because God is hidden, you have to uncover. And this is what rabbinic teaching was about, and this is what Talmud Torah studied. So the lay people needed to be educated in order to see where God is. And it turned out, according to the rabbis, God was found now not just in the temple or behind all kinds of protective walls, but God was in the home. God was at the head of the sick bed. God was in the bed of making love where people are doing this properly. God was in learning Torah and having a family conversation around the table. Now, projecting that trend, my argument is now God is totally hidden. And I mean by totally hidden that we have a secular culture in which one can thesis and one can develop an understanding as if there is no God, or one can only see God not in some dramatic overriding of natural law, but in the natural law. So that means that God, I believe, is available not just in a synagogue or in a so-called holy place, but literally in every place. But you have to look, you have to dig, you have to become sensitized. The logic of what I'm saying is that just as the rabbi said, people must become educated so they will encounter God and know how to relate to God in the hidden place, I'm arguing that today the average layperson will have to become as knowledgeable, as participatory, as aware, as religiously active as the rabbis or the leadership was in the second era. And therefore, we're talking about a democratization that's finally complete. We're living in an age where, at least in capacity and potential, everybody can be a religious, as it were, equivalent of a prophet or rabbi. And that is, of course, the opportunity and maybe the challenge.
When you talk about every human being capable of being a prophet or every Jew or et cetera, it implies that human beings are something pretty special. And I know that core to your thought is the idea of Tzelem Elohim, the idea of human beings in the image of God. And related to that, the infinite value of human beings as sort of a fraction of God. I'd love to hear more from you about how those concepts interweave with what we're talking about and the increased role of human beings in the era that we're in.
Very important point you're raising. And let me start by saying, I still think this is the central value or idea of Judaism. In particular, the way it translates that the central teaching that the human being is in the image of God. That means the human being is such an amazing creature, such an amazing capacity of life, that it should summon up in you. The image is not God. Human beings are not God. That's one of our challenges, that we tend to become God or think we're God, and we become abusive. But I give the always example, in my lifetime, DNA, the code of life, was decoded by two human beings using their brain. Now, again, they didn't make the code. I presume it took the infinite mind of God to create that code. But it's certainly God-like that they could decode it. In fact, not only could decode it, but as a result, we can correct genetic deficits. We can cure diseases. We can do things that are really quite amazing. Now, the human being is the emergence of a really billion plus years of life. And the frontal cortex has given us capacity. And I believe that that's the underlying background. On the one hand, Judaism says you're so amazing that you have fundamental dignities. And this is actually based on a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, in the Talmud, and a teaching which I think is central. The Talmud's interpretation of human being an image of God is that they have three inherent dignities. The way I'd like to put it is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all human beings are created in the image of God, and they are endowed by their creator with three inalienable dignities. And those dignities are infinite value, equality, and uniqueness. Infinite value means that human life is worth everything. It's worth spending millions to save a life. It's worth spending millions to heal and cure a person. In other words, money should be no object. In a principle, every human being should be treated and given whatever they need, whatever it costs, to keep them alive and healthy. I leave it to you to decide whether taking away medical insurance from millions of people, which will threaten their life and health and ability, is compatible with a value system that says human beings are worth infinite value. Now, and take equality. Again, the idea of the image of God means that, unlike human images, in which a Van Gogh is worth more than a Greenberg painting, say, because it's a better quality, human beings, white skin or black skin should not make any, it does not make any difference in terms of value, male or female. In other words, all images of God by definition are equal, says the Talmud. And the third is, all images of God are unique. Now, that's the dignity, and therefore the Jewish dream, and this is the central teaching of Judaism in my claim, is that this world must be repaired and improved so that it fully supports and respects and honors these dignities. In other words, you have to make a world so wealthy that it can spend an infinite amount of money to save a life. You need a world that is so democratic that everybody is treated equal, and there is no oppression, there is no tyranny, there is no discrimination, there is no degrading. And a world that so respects uniqueness that stereotyping is broken, that a discriminatory rejections or lumping of people together are overridden, etc., etc., etc. That is the Jewish, and what Judaism is a revolutionary religion, because it said not only this is what should be, but it claimed that God has recruited humans to join in a partnership to make the world that way. And that's your second point. So image of God has a double meaning. On the one hand, the three dignities that everybody's entitled to. On the other hand, it means we have godlike powers, powers of mind to analyze consciousness, to analyze the universe and figure out the code of DNA and figure out how the power of the atom and of the nuclear, so that we can turn it into a force and into power and to light and figure out technology. So those gifts which we have, says the Judaism, are recruited by God to get everybody to participate in this process of repairing the world. And the goal is, at the end, what I call in this book that I'm writing now, the triumph of life. Namely, we believe that life itself can win out and should win out over all the enemies of life, and of not just of human life, by the way, but I mean things like poverty or hunger or oppression or degradation or war. These are all things that Judaism teaches can and should be overcome. It'll take a tremendous effort, and that's what humans are supposed to do.
Before we go any further, I was hoping that I could talk to you a little bit about language. As I was looking at some of the things that you've written and listening to you, I was finding myself trying to struggle with the idea of image of God as the underlying foundational concept. For many of our listeners and for myself, you know, who struggle or don't believe in God, and how do we think about the God language in a variety of ways? And particularly, you know, I can easily see that for those of us like me, actually, who grew up in a religious environment, then it's the natural way to talk. But I wonder if, especially when we talk about a God that's withdrawing and a God that's in all sorts of unusual relationships with human beings, you know, unusual in terms of the way that Jewish religious world has often talked about it. Are there other ways that we could be thinking about this, or that you've had success sort of translating these ideas that, to make them just as powerful?
The fact that God gives human total responsibility, it seems to me, is another way of God saying what's important is perfecting the world, not worshiping God. What's important is not how you please me or impress me or it's worship me, but what you do for my creatures, for my world. And the way I like to put it is, in a sense, it is now intellectually plausible to be atheist, if not maybe more easily, more intellectually done than to be a believer. But I think that is, if you see it as God's will, then I see it as God, in effect, saying atheist or religion is not important. What's really important is how you treat the image of God, a fellow human being. If you don't want to use language, image of God, my answer is you don't have to. How do you treat the frontal cortex, highly developed form of life, which has all these remarkable qualities? And so, in other words, I think, in a sense, there is a conscious choice here, religiously speaking now, to downplay the formal structural belief in God, statement about God, worship of God, toward the human worldly consequences of such ideas. Now, I want to add one thing personally. I moved in this direction before I even saw the third ear idea for another reason. It really was the impact of the Holocaust on me. One of the most stunning and striking things about the Holocaust, I mean, total degradation, total killing, not just wiping out the Jews, but humiliating, making them suffer first, trying to make them into garbage and into nothing before you killed them. The more I thought of it, the more I felt that here's the following profound truth, very shocking. Some of the people who carried this out were deeply religious. They believed in God. I mean, one of the most shattering scenes I read about in reading the war crime trials, trial of the Einsatzgruppen, and the people that shot men, women, and children daily, killed 1.5 million or more Jews face to face, shooting them down and just massacring day after day for 18 months. Actually, one of the people put on trial as a leader, as a captain, as an important officer, was himself a minister, a religious minister, and others, most of them, 18 out of 25, were highly educated, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, the story goes in Simferopol, which is near in the Crimea. He tells the story, the Einsatzgruppen person, that they were shooting the Jews and killing the Jews in the Crimea, and it was the day before Christmas. And the commander said to them, "We got to finish this job because we want to celebrate Christmas tomorrow. We got to celebrate." He said, "What'd you do?" He said, "Well, we got up early. We got up early that morning. And we took out the last Jews and we shot them all. We got back just in time for the religious celebration." Himmler said to his confidant, Kirsten reports in his diaries, "We insist that every SS man must believe in God. Otherwise, we'd be no better than the atheistic Marxists." I mean, now I said to myself, take that, and now let me take the reverse. Albert Camus, who was an atheist, self-proclaimed atheist, on the index of the Catholic Church of being an atheist, Camus says that in France, he joined the underground when he saw what was going on with the Nazis. Now, he says, he gave this speech to a group of Christians. He said, Christian monks, no less, after the war. He said, "I want you to understand, when I joined, one of the biggest shocks that I learned was that people, Catholics, so I thought old regime reactionary idiots, you know, blind reactionary people, gave their lives to stop this." And then, no less shocking to me, was to meet Marxist communists, my fellow travelers, who sold out and joined. said at one point, I, who was an atheist, I want to tell you, I began to pray, if only the Pope would say something, maybe he could help us fight the Nazis. He said, I don't want to tell you bluntly, you want to call yourself Christian? Be my guest. It means nothing. And I learned calling yourself a Marxist means nothing. To me, it's, are you for or against what's going on here? My conclusion from that was, don't tell me you're religious, you believe in God, and go out and shoot men, women, children. Don't tell me you're an atheist and you give your life to prevent that from being done. My answer is, the atheists will forgive me. If a person is willing to give their life to save the image of God, if a person consistently shows reverence for the image of God, no matter what, then they show, as it were, a recognition of the fundamental sacred reality that's behind the image of God. I'm not God's PR agent who demands he wants membership. We shouldn't be arguing. That's not the division point anymore.
Given what you just said, I have like a next step question. So if the differences between atheists and believers, as you just described beautifully, are really not the core debate of our time, and it's about aligning around belief in the basic infinite value, sacred dignity of human beings, what does that mean for another duality that we think about often in Jewish life, which is sort of Jew and other? You mentioned Camus, who himself was not Jewish, at least as far as I know. It would seem to some folks, maybe, that the divide between an atheist and a theist is a bigger divide than maybe that between believing Jews and believing members of other traditions. I mean, we could question that in a variety of ways. But basically what I'm getting at is, as we enter into an era where, in your view, the role of God is changing, we've talked about how that impacts the role of human beings writ large, but how does that also affect the ideas of Jewish chosenness or the unique role of Jews?
I do believe in the chosenness of Jews. The only point I make is that I think God is a God of multiple choice, by which I mean to say that I don't think we're the only chosen ones. And in fact, what chosen is really trying to say is that I have a experience of being singled out, which, by the way, is another way of saying I'm loved. When I'm loved, when someone loves me, I feel very much singled out. And I think that's what the tradition was trying to say. I believe, A, that God has reached out in the same way through Christianity. I believe God has reached out through secular as well as other religions to human beings, and they have to respond. The Jews should feel the same way as everybody else, namely that they are chosen, that they're important, that they have God's love, but it's meant to be not a source of superiority, but of inspiration to respect and do that to others, to imitate God and do unto others, so to speak, what God has done unto them. So let me rephrase that. My first answer is that I believe pluralism is just as essential in religion. And we see when you have an absolute claim, an absolute authority in the name of God, it leads to the same process, killing, mass killing, cheapening of other people's lives, anybody but your own, et cetera, et cetera. So my answer is, again, that's the challenge for all of us. If every religion and every group would say, I want to achieve, we're part of the achievement of the perfect world, but I can't do it alone. I have to know my own limitations. Even if I have a special relationship to God, I can't do it all. And I say this to the Jews, 12, 14 million people are not going to lift the whole world. If we try, we're going to get a hernia. If the way to do it is to, if you can work with 1,900,000,000 Christians, 1,000,000,000 Muslims, 800 million, 900 million, whatever, Buddhists, Hindus, and if each of those groups will roll up their sleeves and join in this process, we got a shot. That's my point about pluralism. I'm not a relativist. I'm not saying you have to give up belief in God or an absolute of any sort, but you have to know the limits of that belief in absolute. You may have a truth from God, but you don't have all the truth that God has given. Your own truth may have elements of mistake and weakness and error, which you can correct or which you can learn from others to correct. So that is, I see, the future. So again, just as I say, atheist, a religious believer is no longer an absolute line to as the defining point of the person. So is Jewish, non-Jewish, not the absolute line.
So can we talk a little bit more about the substance of Judaism in the Third Era as you see it? Because I think that when a lot of our listeners and a lot of us think about why we're not drawn to Judaism as we know it, in your language, we're looking at a Second Era Judaism and we're living in the Third Era. And so it would seem natural that something that is designed for God where God was in the Second Era and that is designed by people who are trained in that notion, that and that a lot of the practices perhaps are related to relating to God in the place that God was in the Second Era, and now we're in the Third Era. So how do you see some of the specific dimensions of Judaism changing in the Third Era, such as prayer or Jewish law or various practices, holidays, you know, wherever you take that? But it would seem that the Judaism of the Third Era would need to be as different from Rabbinic Judaism as Rabbinic Judaism was from the Second Temple Judaism with its sacrifices and priests and all these dimensions that I think most Jews today would fail to recognize as Judaism.
It's a very telling point, and of course part of the answer I'm going to give is, I don't know, I'm as interested in you to see what happens. I'm looking forward, I don't know if I'll live long enough to see it all, but I'm making some guesses in the book, and I'll make some guesses now, but yes, I think I'm very open, and I think some of it will be new and will not be recognized, or at least not be recognized when it starts. So I believe there will be whole phenomena that will be very different. Or, as I believe, there will be a continuation of past phenomena with new value and new understanding and new direction or focus, and there'll be some improvements or changes in the same way. For example, again, to me, Shabbat, a day of total other than the rest of my week, it's a day in which I'm totally focused on being, even though I'm a workaholic and a hard-driving, doing type and so on. And even though I celebrate human creativity and human productivity, I think it's made possible a tremendous upgrading of life and life dignity. Nevertheless, Shabbat as a day where I totally transform. Now, again, maybe someone will call and say, look, I remember a friend, Haskell Bernhardt, who's a reform rabbi, he said to me, I keep Shabbat, not like you, meaning, I listen to music on Shabbat, which means playing an instrument or turning on radios, which you don't do. Because I feel that music deepens my spirituality, it deepens my sense of the beauty of life, it enriches my emotional and personal relationships, and so on. I said to him, number one, I consider that a valid, it's a pluralist Shabbat, it's a different expression of the same value. So I believe the Shabbat of the Third Era will, I think Shabbat will be a feature of the Third Era. I think it's even more needed now, when you're totally saturated 24-hour cycles of news, and et cetera, and when we are all internet addicted. Whether it will be a total cessation of electronic activity, or whether it will be partial, or as in the case of Bernat's suggestion, that some of the activity will be using what is classically considered melacha or work that's prohibited on Shabbat, but doing so for spiritual and personal growth, and to carry out the deeper being that Shabbat is about, I'm open, and let's find out. And I think that's a good example. Now, maybe in the second year, the rabbi said, since God is hidden, let me help you. You're eating a fruit. Stop and appreciate the beauty of the fruit, the flavor. And you know what? Realize this was created by God. So I made a bracha. The blessing gave you the insight that what seems to be a secular experience, eating a fruit, is really a religious connection to the depth of creation. Okay, what will happen in the Third Era? Will there be a new bracha? Certainly we'll need one. When I'm about to operate to remove a pathology, a cancer that would kill this person, when as a doctor I am developing a genetic improvement that is going to change the quality of life of a person for a lifetime, will that be a bracha? Or maybe it won't be a bracha. Maybe it'll be won't be a blessing. Maybe it'll be a meditation. Maybe it won't be a meditation. Maybe it would just be an attitude. But my point is, in the Third Era, a lot of the religious activity is 7 days a week, not just on Shabbat, because in the activity you have a sense of depth of religious and sacred and the value in the life of the other person. And I go down the line. In other words, if I'm a businessman, can I get a sense that I'm part of Tikkun Olam, and that means not only improving, creating a product that improves life, but how about that the workers who make it for me, that I pay them a living wage, that how about I give them work circumstances that respect their dignity? How about I'm not, as a farmer, taking people and, sweat labor or sweatshop labor or, migrant labor and exploiting them? And again, will I make a blessing over that? How will I express it? I remain fascinated. I think we need some. And again, women never had experiences. I think of my wife's old joke, if rabbis were women, we would have had a humdinger of a bracha, a blessing for giving birth now. Now we have none. Okay, so maybe some of it will be women or other people, newcomers to the experience, will create a new blessing. Or as I said, maybe there'll be an attitudinal, a meditational, a spiritual expression of this sense of wow. So those are some of the new phenomena. Now there'll be new institutions, and again, there'll be secular institutions. I believe that. And I think one of the reasons the synagogue is less effective, you said very simply, because the language of the prayers or the expectations of the rabbis or the claims of the teaching assume a God control that isn't there anymore. And not because I'm an atheist, but because that's the way God is operating right now. So I think there will be new institutions. I think learning will be more important than ever, intellectual learning, understanding, getting the past precedents, getting the past values down, because I play off them. They enrich my repertoire so that I can either apply them directly or modify or develop a parallel new one from them. So learning, I think, will be a dominant education, or as you, I think you once told me too, even if I'm not educated, to have access through internet and be trained to have access to every tradition. It's the old joke, the greatest rabbinic decisor of the past generation was Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he had a tremendous memory, but the truth is not a total photographic one. So a young student with a good computer and access to the Bar Ilan registry of past rulings had access to more information than Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, if we can train him how to apply that information, this is my dream. Every person can be their own decisor. Every person has the strength to an insight to know what to do at this moment based on past records and based on, obviously, my judgment as to how you apply them today.
What's striking to me in hearing you give words of what you've described, in my theological language, is a lot of it is theology, but a lot of it is also what some might think of as politics. And I say that not to demean it. I say that as a great compliment, because to me, I spend a lot of my time thinking about how we have taken a reasonably good concept, if you ask me, of separation of church and state, but we've applied it in an absolutist way to mean separation of religion and politics. And I think that idea that, we hold political viewpoints in one island of our brain, and we hold our theologies, our relationships with God, our rituals in a separate island of our brain, and those islands have no, boats traveling between them. I think that's a harmful idea. And I think you're modeling with this conversation exactly why we need to be taking the theological views that we have, whatever they are. I mean, you've talked about atheist, non-atheist, whatever. Wherever you are on that, that needs to translate into forms of action and activity that are in many ways political. I mean, we talked about Camus stepping in during a time of oppression and war and doing something about it. And that's, of course, a political decision. And I'm just curious to hear from you. I mean, maybe it's in the context of the third era. Maybe it's not. Maybe this is something that we should always have been thinking about. But how can we take the ideas that feel, theological and are, like the uniqueness and the infinite value of every human being, how can we take that, or maybe how should we take that and how shouldn't we take that and apply it into political decision making or other forms of moral issues?
That's an excellent point again, and I came always back to the same rules, which is partial steps and limits are a very important part of this. The reason religion and state were separated were very good reasons. Religion makes absolute claims, at least as understood in those days typically, and they felt correctly that it ends up one religion in charge imposing on others. The absolutism made no room for the kind of give and take and compromise that's workable in a democracy, etc. So they separated. That was a great idea. The problem, again, is the idea of separation, as you said, was absolutized so that it turned into very destructive ways. One example being that the religion no longer had a say, and therefore political life was frequently without any religious or ethical or moral guidelines. Now, religion and ethics are not identical, but nevertheless, there was a tendency. It was also bad for the religious believers who mentally separated the two worlds. And, you know, they joke about the colonial governor says to the Quakers, who were very devout, but they were also known to be sort of shady businessmen. He said, "You pray in church on Sunday and you pray on people the rest of the week." And that's one of the dangers in these situations here in the ethical interhuman relationships. So the trick is, again, to know the limits and apply them. And I think the limits are that, yes, we have absolute goals and absolute values, or infinite goals and infinite values, but we apply them within the limits and reality possibilities, respecting the opposition, respecting the other side. You don't take away medical insurance because they claim the government can't afford it from people because you're dooming them to ill health or to death sometimes. That's not respecting their infinite value. On the other hand, to be honest, if you tried to respect infinite value right now, you wouldn't have enough money. The classic cases of the kidney dialysis, you may recall of reading about it in the 70s, they came out with a study that showed 10,000 people died every year who could be kept alive by dialysis, but they couldn't afford it. The United States government passed a law, well-intentioned, that dialysis would be covered for everybody under Medicare, whatever the equivalent was in those days. Well, within a decade, use of dialysis exploded, including people who organized companies to give dialysis and who took advantage to make a lot of money and all those abuses. But putting that aside, it exploded to the point where the dialysis budget was swallowing up cancer and heart treatment. And so, in a sense, they had to stop and say, no, we're going to have to put a limit on this because heart patients and cancer are more, and besides which, they're also entitled. This is the balancing act. We bring the religion into the politics to try to realize more closely, ever more closely, the ultimate ideals. I think that's a mitzvah that's very important, and religious people should be participatory and use it. But put a limit on it. A, I'm not going to then turn it into, this is an absolute demand. If you don't do it right now, I won't compromise, because that's, it turns out that in willingness to compromise turns into very destructive behavior. It makes democracy impossible, or leads to totalitarianism and other forms in the name of revolution, where you kill all the opponents or you exploit people in the name of a higher ideal. So we're going to have to learn how to apply spiritual values to politics, which turns out to be not a secular activity, but exactly the main place where you can create human value and human dignity, and the main place where God should be present.
Going back to the question of the third era, there are two dimensions that struck me as you were talking that have to do with kind of the overwhelming amount of material that second era Judaism represents. And I sort of look at it from two levels. One is the people who are currently engaged in it, and the other is from the people who aren't. And I think a lot about you know, books that you might read about a business turnaround or those kinds of advice books, and they often include that you should have a stop doing list. You know, that we have limited capacity, and it's very hard to take on new things when your time is already completely occupied with the existing things. And so somehow you have to make room for the new things by stopping to do a certain set of things that you've been doing. And that can be extremely hard for people who have grown used to doing that overwhelming amount of things. And, you know, the sort of obviously thinking about here in terms of your own experience being an Orthodox Jew and a practicing Jew, and how do you think about these new ways that people might sort of reimagine Judaism in these fundamental ways, and having that be additive to what is already sort of expected of Orthodox Jews? Or, you know, and if it's going to ultimately replace some of it, as Rabbinic Judaism did to the sacrifices, for example, How can people on the inside sort of think about that without somehow feeling that they're engaging in some kind of betrayal of the past? And on the flip side, I think it's the question of when we say that this is the lay era and that all these folks who have not been immersed in the world of Jewish practice as it's been are now invited to shoulder the responsibility of leadership, is it realistic and necessary to say, and the ideal is that they will somehow master the knowledge of all of what's come before, or, you know, even, or maybe, for example, the internet actually is the saving grace, right? It's the way in which what you were talking about 30 years ago wasn't quite possible, but now it is, because it turns out that we don't actually have to master all of the material. We just have to master a lens into the material or something of that nature. How do we really make this transition when we have 2,000 years of accumulated second era Judaism?
My answer is let many flowers bloom and let's find out. In other words, let's see which works. Let's see which works. And I can't control, and thank God we are living in a society which is so without centralized control that no one can stop. One of the advantages of living in a society like that is that you have a lot more religious experimentation and a lot more ethical activity than you would have when it needs approval and control from the center. There will be experiments, conscious or unconscious, how much of the past you bring with you and how much of the past you drop, how much of the new stuff do you sacralize and how much do you simply do without sacralizing. But this, I welcome all of the above, and I think we should learn from all of the above. And then if it turns out that one really works a lot better than the other, then I think we would move in that direction. But let's for the moment try it all and see what works. That's step one. Step two is, I do believe the implication of what I'm saying is, the more your responsibility, the more you should know. And if you are responsible in carrying out your responsibility, you want to try to know. So yes, I think we have to upgrade Jewish education. So the average person should have a higher level. I joke about this, but it's not a joke at all. As I think the average layperson someday should have the same access or mastery that the greatest specialized scholars in the second era did. And how is that possible? Probably not possible, but you gave me the answer, I hope. We'll teach them how to use the internet and how to use access, and we'll do more work literally classifying and working out the past records and the angles of understanding of them so that people will have tools to ask good questions and to explore and to apply. And again, as I say at the end, all the past traditions themselves, even from an Orthodox perspective, they don't have the answer for a totally changed environment. You have to apply it and use your judgment. So it's going to be all of the above. Final point on that would be, nevertheless, this, within that framework, individuals will become more specialized. They, in effect, you know, when I give this talk on 30 years, sometimes rabbi will get up and say, but you're saying I have no future, you know. What will the rabbi do in the third year? I'll be out of job. I tell him, no, you know what you can become? In the third year, the laymen are going to be the rabbis, but you can become a rabbi's rabbi, meaning educate them, enable them, be a resource for them. And so I believe there will be both rabbinic and lay resource people, people who have a special feeling for it, a special knowledge, have put more time learning, a special sensitivity and intelligence and intuition as to how to apply it. And such people will emerge as kind of natural guides or leaders in this process.
I think that the distinction is one of authority, right? Because in the second era, the rabbis had authority over the Jews. And in the third era, that authority is probably not there, it's certainly for most Jews, not in the same way. And so I think what's interesting to those rabbis who ask, you know, do I have a job in the future, is that if your vision of that job is it's one where you are an authority that dictates to Jews what they must do, you may be out of a job. If you're willing to accept a job that says, you know, how do I be a guide? How do I be a scholarly advisor or whatever, you know, but I embrace and accept the idea that people may not go in the direction that I think is best. That will be a new definition of the job. And, you know, but I love what you're saying about pluralism in the sense that You know, I'm also thinking about authority in the sense that in the second era, right, Judaism was something that was presented and as a kind of this is what you must do. And in the third era, it's likely to be one that will be defined out of the choices that Jews and perhaps others make.
I say amen to everything you said here. Again, it's part of the creativity. It's alive, it grows, it develops, and I think this is going to be a real opportunity and a real challenge. You know, can I participate in this process? And I think it's a privilege to be alive at such a time because you can contribute to the process too. But in the end, I think that the success, the flourishing, you know, here, what you said about authority is so correct. But again, I'm speaking now God language. That to me is the point of the third era from God's perspective. By becoming totally hidden, by asking people to take human responsibility, God is saying, so what does that mean? God has no authority, no influence? Quite the contrary. I wrote this essay, which became quite controversial, at least in the Orthodox community, saying we're now living in the age of voluntary covenant when it's not, people don't keep it because God is punishing them or because God imposed it or because they once accepted it. But they're keeping it voluntarily because they really believe in the, despite the risks, despite the setbacks, the Jews, they really believe in the vision and the goal. So the authority is no longer imposed, it's earned. And the authority is no longer automatic, it is chosen by those who follow. But I think this kind of authority will be more modest and more credible and more influential. And I think at the end, the majority will end up with a more committed, more substantive, more voluntary, more loving relationship, both to the tradition and to God or whatever that they believe in. And this is part of the long-term upgrade of human dignity. I hope so.
Me too. So I have a question that may seem just sort of like a jump, but I went to my Hillel rabbi when I was in college, and I was going through a year or two of just like rah-rah excitement about Judaism and learning about Judaism. And I asked him to recommend like 5 or 6 books that I was just going to go and immediately read to like learn all about, like learn all the things about Judaism. And one of the books that he told me to read, and which I did, was The Jewish Way, which you wrote, and it's about the holiday cycle of Judaism. And what I love about it, it actually on its cover, the subline is a comprehensive and inspiring presentation of Judaism as revealed through its holy days. And what I love about that is that what it says is not like, I feel like the way we think about holidays is, oh, there's a bunch of times a year where like Jews do certain things and also they have values and also they have laws and also they have rituals, ethics, but we sort of segment those things. I'm talking about islands again. That's clearly where my mind is today. But what you're saying is, with that subtitle, is that Judaism is revealed through the holy days. The days themselves actually create what it is that imbues other elements of Jewish experience, or maybe there's a give and take where the values infuse the holidays and the holidays infuse the values, something like that. But I guess I just love to hear, as we arc towards the close, a little bit from you about what it is about this holiday cycle that is so powerful, what it is about this rhythm of the Jewish year, the Jewish way, that connects to all of the things that we've talked about on this episode.
First of all, thank you. It happens to be a book that remains a long-time personal favorite, and for the reason that you said, I was trying to show that it's not just a collection of behaviors, even though a lot of those behaviors are fun, and I love matzo balls and so on. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a good, delicious approach to Judaism, taste and see God as good as in the Psalms, but nevertheless, I think to me it was something else altogether. I come back to that. I think Judaism at its heart is a vision of a world redeemed, perfected, and of a world full of life and human dignity winning out over all its enemies. That's its heart. And how do I live in two ways? Meaning, how do I live and work toward that kind of a world? And how do I live in the interim in situations where I can't live by the ultimate, but I'd like in some way my action to reflect this ultimate vision? And that's what the holidays capture. And of course, the other thing they capture is the way Jewish religion is a response to Jewish history and experience. So again, it's not some remote God intervenes and says, do this, do that. It's really a direct reflection of our historical experience. So the Exodus, you know, which again remains the core event of Jewish life and religion and history, because liberating the slaves and taking them to a homeland where they can live in dignity, that's the core Jewish message about the whole world, not just the Jewish people, but someday the whole world, and so on. So what I loved about the holidays is that they took the events of our history and they put them into a pattern of meaning. And based on that pattern of meaning, they developed behavior patterns. I remain loving the holidays in that book because it captures both elements, the elements of that the events of our lives and a history are part of a pattern of working for redemption in history, that the events affect us and we remember them and we pass them on from generation to generation in order to live up to this calling, but also that the events themselves and the liberation during the week as well as during the holidays are about living life today on the side of life as well. I'd add one more comment, which I loved about that book, and it was very deliberately so. The last holidays in the book are Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Commemoration Day, and Yom HaTzmaut, Israel Independence Day. I don't think the holiday pattern stopped, and this is the mistake of traditionalism or of orthodoxy when it's not thinking, which is to say all these revelations took place and now I have to keep them and there's nothing else. There's new living dynamic experiences, and these two great events become part of the cycle, just as the destruction of the temple became a fast day and as the redemption from Egypt became a holiday celebration, so are these things. And I would go on. I'm sure there'll be more holidays and more celebrations. So part of the job of being a living religion is to incorporate the new Rav Kook, chief rabbi of Israel before Israel became a state, once said, our task as religious leaders is that the old shall be renewed and the new shall be made sacred. I think that's exactly what a vital living religion does. It sacred means value, intensity of life. We have the double task of taking from the past what vitalizes and intensifies life, what enriches it, and where it doesn't, correcting it or improving it. And we have to take the new and bring it into the sacred realm. So I believe there'll be new holidays and there'll be a lot of things. But I hope in the spirit of people understanding that life is a cycle, that a conscious life is richer. Again, if you live totally without tradition, you're living in one century. The beauty of Jewish tradition, I think, is you're living in multiple centuries. It's like stereophonic music is a lot richer than monophonic. And in the same way, I think these traditions give us a depth of living. And these visions give us an intensity of living. And I think that's what Judaism is trying to give the world. I hope the whole world join in this process of living more intensely, embracing life more fully, and working to improve the conditions so that everybody in the world enjoys this opportunity.
Thanks again for coming on to Judaism Unbound. It's been an honor.
My pleasure, and thank you for asking good questions.
We hope you've enjoyed this 100th episode of Judaism Unbound, and we're going to close it out in the same way we have the previous 99, by encouraging you to be in touch with us, and there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us with a financial gift, either on a monthly recurring basis or on a one-time basis, and you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.